Hello, and welcome to the Practitioner Scholar, the Penn CLO podcast. In this podcast, we journey through the intersection of academic rigor and real-world impact, spotlighting the practitioner scholars who are shaping the future of organizational learning and leadership. Whether you're an aspiring leader, a seasoned executive, or simply intrigued by the transformative power of education and research, this is the place for you. So sit back and prepare to unlock new perspectives as we delve into the compelling stories and insights that will define the future of learning and leadership.
Hello, and welcome to our episode of the Practitioner Scholar, a Penn Chief Learning Officer podcast. I'm Melissa Monti, and I will be your host. For those who don't know, the Penn CLO program is an executive doctoral degree path through the University of Pennsylvania's Graduate School of Education. I'm also a current student of this program as well. We've been fortunate to have celebrated the successes of many Penn CLO students and alumni as they have grown into thought leaders of organizational learning throughout the public and private sectors. However, in this edition, we will specifically highlight the achievements of Dr. Candy Weens, now a senior fellow at the University of Pennsylvania and author of the new book, Burnout Immunity. Getting to know her a bit more, Dr. Weens holds multiple degrees and graduated from the Penn CLO program in 2016. Since then, her research has focused on the topics of burnout, emotional intelligence, and organizational resilience. She is an executive coach. She also holds a faculty position with the Police Executive Leadership Institute and a 26-year track record of organizational change consulting. Most importantly, she says she is passionate about creating learning experiences that help people walk in their purpose and lead with their values. With that being said, we are thrilled to welcome Dr. Weens to our program. Thank you for joining us today. May I call you Candy?
Yes, please call me Candy.
All right, thank you so much. Today, we will explore several topics, including key takeaways from your research, how your findings impact workplace learning, details on your new book, and how the Penn CLO program ultimately impacted your career. But first, I would love to start with an interesting anecdote that you shared with our program several months back. I think it provides interesting context to your research motivations, of course. Could you tell us a little bit about your health scare several years back while you were juggling work, school, and also family life?
Sure, I'd be happy to share a bit about this. And I did share my story with the Penn CLO students a couple of months ago. It's one that triggers some really difficult memories. As you hear me tell this story, notice that I still carry a lot of that stress in my voice, which is part of what I'm learning to do today as I apply my emotional intelligence skills to continue to manage the stress that I experienced and what eventually led to a life-threatening wake-up call. At the time, about 10 years ago, I led a very busy life like many of our current students and our alumni. I had three kids at home and I was traveling a lot for work and for school. I was in the middle of the Penn CLO doctoral program. And it started to hit me. I started to notice things weren't quite right when I was sitting in class one day. It was a Friday afternoon, and I got an email from my youngest son's kindergarten teacher. And the email contained a video clip of my son making a recording. And it was just happened to be a day that they were doing what was called Muffins for Moms. It was the Friday before Mother's Day. And because I was not in his classroom, his teacher took a video of him sending me a very sweet message, basically telling me that he loved me and he missed me and that he was proud of me for going to school. And when I was sitting in class and I saw that video, it just all of a sudden hit me that I was missing out on some pretty key, meaningful moments in my personal life and my family life. And I had this sensation for a while that I was doing too much, that I was really losing a bit of focus on what my true core values were. It had been there, but I was burying it because I felt like I was really just so focused on pursuing my dream, which was important to me. But I wasn't realizing at the time that these sacrifices were impacting more than just me. It was impacting my family as well. So that meaningful moment, the passage of that meaningful moment was the beginning of a wake-up call. Fast forward a week after that, literally 1 week later, I was in my doctor's office just for a normal checkup, the one where you go in and out of your doctor's office. You think you're going to be in there for 20 minutes, you get your A and you go back to work. And the nurse took me back to the exam room. She checked my blood pressure. She checked a second time, a third time, a fourth time without saying anything. She went out into the hallway, and while she was gone, I did what most of us would do, and I picked up my phone and I started checking my emails and responding to a couple of texts. At the time, I didn't feel necessarily overly stressed, but I did feel a bit anxious. And I do remember thinking, I've got to get back to work because I have a lot of prep work to do for this big leadership development program next week. So anyway, the nurse leaves the room, and about a minute later, the nurse and my doctor walked in, and my doctor came in and she held my hand and she sat down on the exam table next to me. And she asked me, she looked in my eyes and she asked me, Candy, are you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm fine. Again, felt a little anxious, a little stressed, but nothing out of the norm that felt normal to me. She said, we're going to give you a little bit of medicine. I want you to lie down here for a bit, and I'm going to call your husband and have him come and pick you up. And then I started to get pretty nervous about what was going on. She told me that my blood pressure reading was a 200 over 110. I did not know at the time what that meant. I really had no idea how scary that was. I just knew by the look on her face that it wasn't normal. Turns out that a blood pressure reading that high can lead to any number of really debilitating and detrimental physical effects, including loss of eyesight, stroke, heart attack, even death. They were about to send me to the emergency room, but fortunately, the blood pressure medicine that they gave me, as well as a really strong dose of Xanax, was enough to bring my blood pressure down. Once my husband came, she then gave my husband some instructions because I was quite tired and lethargic at that point. But she instructed my husband, I wasn't supposed to do anything for at least the next 3 to 5 days. I wasn't supposed to go to work the following Monday. So my first thought when I heard her say that I had to stay home from work for a couple of days after the weekend, my first thought was, I can't stay home. I have a big leadership development program to run next week. I can't take time out of my schedule to just lay on the couch. My second thought was, finally, I think she just ordered me to just get some rest and sleep. This is like the permission that I've been waiting for, to just slow down and sleep and just rest, let my body rest. And then my third thought, when it really hit me, was, she's absolutely right. I'm not fine. This is not normal to have this kind of a wake-up call, this kind of a physical experience where your body is screaming at you to slow down. So that was the beginning of that wake-up call and what led to eventually this big interest in me wanting to understand what was leading to my stress, what was causing me to have that type of a physical reaction to it. And ultimately, it's what led me to be so interested in stress and burnout research and eventually the emotional intelligence research as well.
Now, in retrospect, thinking back on sort of your operating rhythm, are there signs that you see now that you were just going with no stop?
Yes. And that is a big part of what I write about. Actually, it's the second chapter of the book. It's all about developing awareness of many things. But one of the key elements of awareness is paying attention to the very subtle signs that your psyche and your body are telling you, not just to slow down, but to pay attention to what the stress is doing to you. And I learned recently, I wish I would have learned this many years ago, but I actually just within the last several weeks, I learned recently from an author that I've been following that every once in a while, it's so important to just stop, pause, and ask yourself, what am I doing? And what is it doing to me? Two questions sound so straightforward and simple, but it really in practice, if we ask ourselves those questions throughout the day, like not just once in a while, but literally throughout the day, what am I doing right now? And what is it doing to me? So at the time, 10 years ago, when I had that scare, I wasn't doing enough of that. I was living in this state of almost unawareness. I was just so focused on my goals and so focused on avoiding going back to the lifestyle that I had before I achieved some of the success that I had realized. So there were a lot of things that were driving that unawareness for me. And that's one of the things I'm just extremely passionate about right now, is just helping people understand that how important awareness is. And there are so many ways that we can do that we can enhance our awareness.
Thank you for sharing that story. That's definitely scary. I can only imagine what was going through your mind at the time. Thank you again. Let's take a moment to define key terms for the purpose of this podcast. What are your definitions of burnout, and emotional intelligence, and how do the two intersect?
Yes, because they do intersect. So burnout, as the researchers who have been studying this concept or this construct called burnout since the early 1990s, we all agree that it's a physical and mental and psychological manifestation of chronic stress at work. So it's primarily characterized by the stress that we experience at work. Although the last several years, a number of researchers have agreed that this concept or construct of burnout goes well beyond just what we experience at work. And it's a result of what we experience in our entire life. So burnout essentially is a psychological syndrome. It does have physical manifestations as well, but it's primarily characterized as a psychological syndrome where we experience three common symptoms. And it could those symptoms could vary person by person. The first symptom or the first sign that we're starting to feel burnout is that feeling of just utter and total emotional exhaustion. If you've ever had that feeling where you wake up in the morning and before you even open your eyes, you think to yourself, I just can't even imagine getting out of bed today and going to work. I'm just so depleted emotionally. And primarily that feeling comes from serving other people. That's why we see in the health professions, caring professions, even in law enforcement or with educators as well, professions that require us to give a lot of emotional energy to other people, where at the end of the day, we just feel so drained and depleted. If we experience that for long periods of time, that can really increase that level of emotional exhaustion. The second symptom is called depersonalization or cynicism. And that's the feeling that we have about other people at work. So it's that general feeling that I have a kind of a more negative or more bad attitude about other people that I work with. And that could be colleagues, peers, it could be customers or patients or students. It could be anyone in our work environment, but just having a less optimistic or positive view about other people. And then the third symptom or sign of burnout is what's called a lack of professional efficacy. And that's just a fancy way of saying that I feel less effective at my job than I normally do. And that occurs oftentimes when people are new to a role, they're new to an organization, they're experiencing some new big change at work that's requiring them to pull on new skills or develop new skills. And that just makes them feel oftentimes like I'm just not as effective or not in my groove at work the way that I normally am. The interesting thing about professional efficacy is that it's the exact opposite, or it can counteract the feelings of emotional exhaustion or cynicism. So the more efficacious that we feel at work, in other words, the more effective and confident I feel in my abilities, the less likely I am to feel emotionally exhausted or to feel cynical about other people at work. So that's the common definition of burnout that most burnout researchers and the World Health Organization agree with. And then emotional intelligence is a construct that's been around for really literally hundreds of years, but it was around the late 1980s, 1990s that Daniel Goleman popularized the concept and brought it to our attention in the popular media. He later did a lot of research with Richard Boyatzis out of Case Western, and then our own Dr. Annie McKee, who was the director of the Penn CLO program for a number of years and is still an adjunct faculty member at Penn GSE. So I've fortunately been able to study under Dr. Annie McKee, and the current most common definition of emotional intelligence is that it consists of four different domains. The first two domains have to do with self-awareness and self-management. So my ability to be aware of, understand, and manage my emotions, thoughts, and behaviors. That's a very simplistic definition of those first two domains of emotional intelligence. The second two domains of EI have to do with my ability to perceive, understand, and manage what's going on in my social environment, my ability to build strong, healthy relationships with other people, my ability to empathize with other people, my ability to participate in and effectively lead other people in a team situation. So the two intersect, burnout and emotional intelligence intersect in really interesting ways, which is what my research has been focused on. And I'd be happy to tell you more about that. But my studies have been some of the first that have directly looked at ways in which leaders and even individual contributors, you don't have to be a leader to use your EI, but people of all walks of life, any profession, any industry, in any country My research has been looking at ways that we can use our EI specifically to manage stress and truly protect ourselves from burnout.
You mentioned a few key sources for information. Who else have you worked with to determine what burnout really means? This could be anyone from medical doctors to psychologists, possibly other academic scholars. Tell me a little bit about how you gathered your information.
So lots of great research out there in both the fields of burnout and emotional intelligence. So I've been reading and resilience and some of the other constructs that have informed these other big bodies of literature. So I've been looking at scholars in these fields for a number of years. Daniel Goleman, Richard Boyatzis, Annie McKee are the primary thought leaders and researchers in the emotional intelligence space. And then in the burnout space, it's Christina Maslach, Michael Leiter, a number of others. As far as primary research, my research has been focused on chief medical officers. I do a lot of work with law enforcement. I've now done focus studies with a number of large law enforcement agencies in Los Angeles, Seattle, Portland, Vancouver, Oklahoma City, and a number of other smaller law enforcement agencies where we're studying both police chiefs as well as that one or two levels below a police chief. I've also studied leaders in many different industries, and I've been known to even interview bartenders and baristas. I will literally talk to anyone and everyone who is interested in opening up to me about what their experiences are when it comes to stress at work and how they deal with it. And it turns out, I believe from my research anyway, that regardless of the industry or the role or even where you work in the country, or really any country, it really doesn't matter. These tools and strategies of emotional intelligence can be applied in any type of role, leadership or non-leadership role.
And what are the sentiments, I'm just curious, from some of your research participants? Do they say, thank you for bringing awareness to this, I thought I was alone, or something similar to that?
Yes. Yeah, that's been one of the most rewarding parts of my research, is that if you think about it, for those of us who are qualitative researchers, we are there to collect data. We are there to hear people's stories and to walk away with data that we can then turn into codes. And those codes get turned into themes. So there's a whole process of data collection as a researcher. But one of the things that I didn't fully appreciate until I got into the interview process is that qualitative interviews are essentially an intervention. They're an intervention in your study participants' lives. And just to give you one example, I'll never forget one chief medical officer that I interviewed. Before our interview, he took the Maslach Burnout Inventory. It's basically a research instrument that tells us whether or not someone is burned out. And I saw his results before I conducted the interview with him. And he rated his stress level as a 9 out of 10, meaning that he was describing his stress as very severe, borderline worst possible stress. And he did characterize as burned out on the Maslach Burnout Inventory. He actually had quite a high level of burnout. And in my interview with him, he was kind enough to share a number of stories with me that I reported on. But towards the end of the interview, he started weeping. And we were on Zoom, and I saw him weeping a bit. And I asked him if he was okay. And I immediately took off my researcher hat, and I put on just my executive coaching hat and my supportive friend hat. And I asked him, Dr. Smith, disguise his name, but I asked him, are you okay? And he said, I am okay. Actually, this conversation is really opening my eyes. He said, I'm starting to realize more and more that I am suffering. I'm suffering and my family is suffering. And I've known for a while that I need to do something differently. So I noticed that his story was similar to mine, that he noticed a little bit. He had some level of awareness, but he wasn't necessarily doing what he needed to do. He wasn't what I call aware and care. So he might have had a bit of an awareness that he was struggling and suffering, but it wasn't until the interview where he was opening up to do something different.
So that awareness is kickstarting the journey, which
exactly.
is super important.
Yes.
Good. You've published several Harvard Business Review articles on using emotional intelligence to building resilience. In fact, just wanted to let you know, I was scrolling down LinkedIn yesterday and I saw a new article from you. I think it was just recently published. So congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, it just came out yesterday.
In your opinion, how is this done, using emotional intelligence to build resilience? And is it sustainable over the long term?
Yes. yes, we can build it. And yes, we can use our EI. And yes, we can sustain it, but it does take hard work. So that's what we're going to talk about, is truly the foundation of my book, Burnout Immunity. So in Burnout Immunity, you'll see that the chapters are organized by a resilience framework that I created. The acronym is ARMOR, A-R-M-O-R. So really briefly, the A is for awareness. And so in that chapter about awareness, you will learn all kinds of tools and strategies. There are a number of exercises that describe how becoming aware of not just what's making us more vulnerable to burnout in our current work environment, but also an awareness of my temperament and my personality and ways in which I might be causing and amplifying stress for myself based on my temperament, my personality, and my past experiences. It also includes a whole section on having an awareness of what triggers our stress and why things are triggering us. Melissa, for example, you and I could be working in the same stressful work environment, have the same boss, same conditions, but I might experience that stress much more intensely than you, just based on my past experiences, or again, because of my personality. And I might be triggered by things that you are not triggered by. So having an awareness of all of these things and more, there's more in that chapter, are the first and the most important step to then moving through the ARMOR framework. The second chapter is R, which is all about regulation. That's the emotional intelligence competency that we often hear of as self-management, self-regulation, impulse control. So that chapter is all about how we manage and regulate our emotions, our thoughts, and our behaviors. It also has a lot of information in there about how to really learn about your unique stress response. Each of us has a very different stress response biologically and psychologically. And so the more we learn about our stress response, the better we're able to regulate it, the better we're able to tune into what are the things that help me regulate my stress response, whether I'm experiencing acute or chronic stress. The third chapter of the book, the M, is for meaningful connections. And in that book, I talk about how we can use our emotional intelligence to connect to relationships, to our values, and to meaningful work. And each one of those things requires us to have an awareness of what's important to us, as well as having the ability to regulate our emotions, thoughts, and behaviors so that we can focus on and dedicate time and energy to meaningful connections, our values, and meaningful work. The O in the ARMOR framework is about our outlook. Think of outlook as mindset. So the ways that we look at life, the way that we look at how we lead other people. So in that chapter, I walk readers through the four vital mindsets of resilient role models of people who have burnout immunity. So I talk about servant leadership, how that helps us. I talk about how having a stress is enhancing mindset helps us navigate stress and protect ourselves from burnout. The third mindset that really contributes to burnout immunity is having a positive outlook, which happens to be a very specific emotional intelligence competency. It really encompasses all of the ways in which we view things as either optimistic or pessimistic, and how having a positive outlook really changes our subjective experience of stress itself. And then the fourth vital mindset that I talk about is the aware and care mindset. I mentioned before that it's not just important to have an awareness of what stress is doing to us, but we have to take that next step and actually care enough for and about ourselves to do something differently. So that aware and care mindset is that fourth vital mindset. And then the final R, the final chapter of the book, is all about recover, reconnect, and reimagine. It's what I call the 3RX prescription for resilience and for burnout immunity. So recover is all about how to heal from burnout, or if you are at high risk of burnout, how to back off and build more recovery into your schedule, into your life, so that you can reduce your risk of burning out. The second R is about reconnecting. So it brings us back to the meaningful connections chapter, where we learn how to reconnect to our values, our purpose, and to relationships. And then the last R in the 3RX prescription is reimagining. So once we've healed from burnout, once we're reconnecting to the things and the people in our lives that are most important, and once we can change our view of our stressful work experiences and our environment, we can begin to reimagine the type of relationship that we want to have with work going forward. I'll never forget a question that I was asked in an interview. Is that actually Dr. Annie McKee asked me this question when she interviewed me for my job at Penn. She asked me, how do you want work to fit into your life? And that question right there is about reimagining. So that final R in that final chapter is about not just imagining your ideal self, but really reimagining this relationship that you want to have with work and how you want work to fit into your life and not the other way around.
Hearing this, some may say, I simply don't have time to be more mindful. How can we debunk this myth of not having time for better wellness practices, do you think?
Number one, advice to all my friends who are listening and advice to myself, I have to remember that you can't afford not to, truly. I mean, if you care about your health and your well-being, and if you were to sit down and be completely honest with yourself about what you value, and many of us say that we value our health and our well-being and all of that, but we can't afford to ignore the signs. So a lot of the tips and strategies that you will learn in Burnout Immunity don't take extra time. Some of this stuff is just a mindset shift. It's training yourself to think differently about your stressors. It's training yourself how to recognize the signs. So they're not necessarily the type of things that will take you more time or even more effort. You're just going to be thinking about things differently. And yes, you will be doing things differently. You may be setting boundaries differently. You may be distancing yourself from toxic coworkers and putting up more emotional boundaries. But that doesn't necessarily take you more time. It's just a different way of doing things.
To many of us, myself included, the process of researching and writing a book seems pretty daunting. You're on your way to your very first book release. Congratulations again.
Thank you.
How did you embark on those first few steps, if you wouldn't mind sharing, from thinking about a topic, which it sounds like you had one in mind, to translating your research into relatable literature?
Yeah. So while I was conducting all my research for my dissertation, and then I continued conducting a few studies after I graduated, I always had this idea in the back of my head that I wanted to write a book. And more than anything, it felt like a fantasy and a dream, something that I wanted to do, but I didn't actually think that it would happen. I really didn't. And I came up with the ARMOR framework one day when I was out on a walk, and it just all of a sudden hit me. And I thought, wait a minute, if I can put this into a framework that makes sense when I teach it, when I teach a workshop or deliver a keynote, then maybe there is something there that I could turn into a book. So that's where it started to get real, turned from fantasy and a dream to actually do something with it. So then I started to get really practical. Okay, what do I need? If I have the idea, I have the research, I can actually envision what will be in this book, but I need help. I can't do this alone. I felt like I was a good writer, and I knew academically that I could write scholarly pieces, I could write Harvard Business Review pieces, but writing a book is a very different animal. It's scary, especially when you have a full-time job and three teenage boys at home. I started looking into writing coaches, and I worked with a couple of different writing coaches who were incredibly helpful, but it wasn't until I met Catherine Knepper. Catherine was introduced to me by one of my HBR editors, and Catherine and I just hit it off immediately, and I knew I need to partner with this woman. And so she and I wrote the book together. She helped me conduct a lot of the secondary research. She took a lot of my stories that I would record into a voice recorder, or I would send her what she would call a word salad, just messy drafts. And then she would help me just put it together in a way that just made it sing. So for anyone who's considering writing a book, but you're not quite sure about your writing skills, or you just don't have the time to write, I don't think there's nothing wrong with hiring a writing coach. She didn't write the book for me, but she helped me learn how to write the book. And then she introduced me to my agent. And then from there, things turned into a snowball effect of different introductions here and there.
Yeah. And many are likely not aware that it truly takes a village to publish a book, as you mentioned. So tell us a little bit more about the team you've surrounded yourself with in order to bring this work to life.
Yeah, I love my team. Absolutely love my team. Catherine, my writing coach, introduced me to Jill Marcel, my agent, who then helped me get my contract with HarperCollins, who is my publisher. So there's an entire team at HarperCollins, editors, marketing team, sales team, that they're helping me at this point with the whole marketing strategy. I've surrounded myself with a team of social media experts. I have a publicist, actually two publicists now that I'm working with. And I'm also working with a marketing firm that focuses on bulk orders. So that group of people will help me process books. If people want to order 10 or more books, they help me with that part of the marketing strategy. So yes, I've surrounded myself with a lot of people. And yes, it's expensive. But when you write a book that is being published by a big publisher, oftentimes it comes with a sizable advance. So that advance has been able to help me afford to surround myself with just an incredible team.
And I'm not sure if you mentioned, but it's a woman-led team.
Yes, about 99% of the people that I'm working with on my team. I forgot to mention, I have a team that's helping me design and develop a new website, which will be launched in a couple of weeks. But almost all women, 98-99% of them are women. I'm super excited. And they're all invested in and excited about this book and getting this message out to folks.
I love that. That's amazing. Now, beyond the marketing, in terms of other engagements that you have lined up, tell me a little bit about some media interviews or possibly some keynote speaking events that you have in relation to the book release.
Yeah. I think one of the best investments I've made with my advance payment was to hire this publicist called 48 PR. They have been securing media interviews. Last week, I did one with Men's Health and another with Fortune magazine. I have just yesterday, they scheduled me for 4 podcasts coming up. There's a lot of traction going on. They're lining up outlets for me to publish articles. I just wrote one for Leader to Leader, which is Frances Heiselbein's organization. They are pitching me to New York Times. They will eventually pitch me to all kinds of media, television. They have a podcast strategy. But in addition to that, I continue to do a number of keynotes, which I've been securing on my own. I have a number of private clients that I work with. And then I'll have people reach out to me occasionally, just have heard from me through Harvard Business Review or have heard about me on LinkedIn and invite me to do either a keynote or a workshop with them.
Very good. I wish you luck.
Thank you.
When readers finish your book and put it down, what is the one thing you hope they are taking away from it all and possibly applying to their everyday lives?
I am confident that readers who actually read the book and internalize what I'm sharing with them will walk away with skills and strategies and tools. I guarantee that it is written for people to walk away with practical, realistic, and accessible tools and strategies. What I think people will also walk away with that they may be surprised about is a feeling of empowerment and a feeling of inspiration that they will see, not just from me sharing my story, but from a number of other stories of interview participants, people that I've been researching for years, that these stories are truly inspiring. These are everyday people and executive leaders who experience just extreme levels of stress at work, yet they are not burned out. And so their stories are just incredibly inspiring as you read the details of what their day is like and what the types of stress that they are experiencing, yet they are applying their emotional intelligence to protect themselves from burnout. And if they can do it, I know that we can do it. I've been using and applying everything I've learned from my research participants, and I feel incredibly empowered. I know that I can do it. I on my organization. I don't have to rely on other people's work. I rely on myself and my emotional intelligence to improve my psychological well-being. And that's really empowering.
Being a former Penn student yourself through the CLO doctoral program, how do you feel that experience contributed to where your career has taken you today? Basically, how has the program shaped and influenced your identity, do you think?
Not just shaped my identity, transformed, really. I can't say enough about the Penn CLO program. It was during the program that I had that major life-threatening wake-up call with stress. And it was during the program that I started learning about emotional intelligence. And it was during the program that I started gaining my confidence in my ability to become a researcher. I met so many amazing people in the program that have been such an incredible support system, of course, during the program, but also since the program. One of my very best friends to this day is someone that I met 10 years ago in the program. He was one block ahead of me, and he's just been an incredible support system ever since then. And so it's not just the content, it's not just the work that we do to become researchers, how that transforms our identity, but it's also just the experience of being surrounded by like-minded people who are just so intellectually curious about different topics. That's so inspiring, and it's almost impossible it would have been impossible to not transform my identity. And I see that with so many of our students and alums who go through the program. who have similar experiences of just really having that transformational identity transformation experience.
For prospects out there considering a doctoral program who may also wonder if they can balance it all, I have definitely been there myself. Mm-hmm. What advice would you share?
The advice I would share is to trust your faculty members, trust the Penn CLO program directors, that they will help you get through it. They see every single one of our students. I should say we see, because I'm a part of that faculty team. We see our students. We see what we have insight into their personal lives, and we know how difficult their careers are and balancing their family life with school and everything. And we are there to support you. And so to every person out there who's thinking about applying to the program, just know that you will have an opportunity to be surrounded by an incredible faculty team, as well as the peers in your cohort. The other thing I would just advise everybody to think about is think long and hard about managing your work schedule. And so if there are things you can do now to adjust your work schedule, take time off, maybe go back to only 80% time, something like that. I scaled my hours back for a period of time when I was working on my dissertation. But anything you can do to just manage some of your work boundaries so that you can really focus on your schoolwork during some of those crunch times.
In your opinion, what is the best part of seeing results with your consulting and your teaching endeavors? How are you measuring success, both personally and professionally?
I measure success in a couple of different ways. Number one, the impact that I see this work having on other people. There have been countless times where I have finished a keynote, I've come up the stage, a few minutes later, I go to the bathroom, freshen up, and someone will approach me in the bathroom. Sometimes a couple of people will approach me in the bathroom. One woman just several months ago was in tears, and she told me that it was really inspiring her to make some changes, that she knew she needed to have a hard conversation with her boss about her workload and her hours. To me, that's a clear indication, a clear example of the impact that this work is having on other people. The other way that I measure success is my ability to keep my stress in check. It's very easy for me, someone who's a serious, insecure overachiever, that's hardwired in me. So it's really easy for me to throw myself into a million different things at once, overcommit, and then regret it a little bit later because I'm just not setting the boundaries that I need to manage my psychological health. And so to me, a measure of my success is my ability to protect myself from burnout, to really live and role model the skills and behaviors and the mindset that I hope other people will learn.
On a more lighthearted note, and maybe I'm looking for recommendations here, mm-hmm. What is one unique, possibly quirky thing that you do or like to do to relax?
Oh, I love this one. One of my coworkers, a friend of mine, is having her first baby in a couple of weeks. And so for her baby present, I bought her, hopefully this won't air until after she has her baby shower, but I bought her this pink blanket, and it is the softest blanket I've ever seen in my entire life. And so when I was taking it out of the packaging and wrapping it for the baby shower, I was touching it and I thought, oh my God, this blanket could be life-changing. I need to order one of these for myself. So I went online and sure enough, they have an adult version of it. And the blanket feels like rabbit fur, like bunny fur. And so when I am just like really overwhelmed, I find myself going through emails and I feel like I have way too many things coming at my psyche faster than I can manage. And just starting to feel my anxiety level go up, I'll just take a moment and just go sit on the couch with my blanket and just meditate for 5 minutes. And 5 minutes out of my day is, yes, I can rationalize it as it's cutting into things that I should be doing. But no, that's probably one of the most important things I can do for 5 minutes is just sit with my blanket and meditate. And that right there can bring my stress response back to an equilibrium level where then I can get back to work with a little bit more of a clear head.
I have been there as well, just so you know. I'm a big fan of the cozy blankets.
They work.
All right. One final question for you. Can we do it all and do it well at the same time? What are your thoughts?
I think that depends on what your definition of having it all is. Years ago, I remember one of the best pieces of advice I ever got was make sure you're very clear on what your definition of having it all is. Don't live by anyone else's definition of what having it all is. So that's job number one is what does that mean? And that takes us back to our values. So for me, yes, I do have it all because my values include my psychological well-being, my physical health, my relationships with my family. So when I stay focused on my values and those values are informing my definition of success, yes, I can have it all because I've started with the right definition.
Dr. Weens, thank you again so much for your time. This has really been an inspiring session for me, and I'm sure a lot of our audience members as well too. Your book that we mentioned, Burnout Immunity, will be released on April 23rd. Congratulations again. And for those who would like to contact you or follow some of your great work, what is the best way for them to do this?
Yeah, please feel free to reach out to me on LinkedIn, or you can email me directly at candyweens.com. And I'd love to hear from people.
All right. Thank you so much again for your time.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of another enriching episode of The Practitioner Scholar, the PenCLO podcast. We hope you found inspiration in the stories and insights shared today. These narratives serve as a testament to the transformative impact that well-informed leadership can have across organizations and industries. Don't forget to subscribe, share, and stay engaged as we continue to explore the ever-evolving landscape of leadership and learning. Thank you, and goodbye until next time.